Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Richard Allen confessed to shooting Abby and Libby in the Delphi case. That's pretty damning, isn't it? Right? Except they weren't shot. That's not how the crime went. It was a blade. Then he confessed to essaying them. Pretty damning too, right? On its surface, like, holy shit, he's confessed. Except there was no evidence of that. That didn't happen either. He also confessed while claiming he started World War III. Whoa. So he shot these two girls, essayed them, and started World War III? This is a pretty bad dude, except none of those things have happened, at least as of this recording. He confessed also while believing he was dead. So he's a zombie. He started World War III. He killed them with a gun. And then there was SA involved too. Again, wow. Except none of it's real. Except these are delusional thoughts coming from a man who's been described by medical professionals as gravely disabled. He was also smearing himself with feces and declaring he was King Michael. Made 60 confessions during a period when prison doctors, again, diagnosed him as gravely disabled and very psychotic. And the Indiana Department of Corrections was forcibly injecting him with antipsychotic medication. Seems like a great time to take a confession and use it in court, right? Because I'm sure anything that's being said while someone is claiming to basically be a zombie, having started World War III, committed these crimes in ways the crimes were not committed, and being King Michael while being injected with drugs and eating your own poop. Seems like a great confession. That'll stand up in court, right? Here's the disturbing part. It did. It did stand up in court. That's the thing. Despite the defense saying, this isn't admissible, this is insane. This is a madman. You've locked him away in solitary confinement. You've violated the Geneva Convention. You violated your own state and federal rules on putting people in solitary confinement that have not been convicted of a crime. You tortured the man. You denied him access to his legal counsel. Or the autonomy of choosing staying in local jail or going to a federal prison, which you would have a say in, but you took that away from him too, Indiana. So you have all of that. And then he finally confesses after you torture him. But that little confession that you get, although not a confession to the actual crime, you're going to say, well, I don't want to say round and square peg because we're so far different here. It's not even a peg. This Buick, this 76 Buick should fit in through this little square hole over here, right? It's not even a square peg. It's a Buick. That's how different we're talking about here in this case of what they're trying to jam. And they tried to jam it through. They tried, all right. And that's why we're still talking about this case, because it was insane. The confessions they got were the centerpiece of the state's case against him. And in Indiana, apparently, that's all you need. That's all you need to convict somebody of a horrific crime like this when they have no record of doing anything of the sort ever. In fact, he volunteered and said, hi, how can I help? Before I walk you through what happened in Westville, I want you to hold something in your mind. On October 13th of 2022, the day Allen was arrested, Detective Holman interrogated him for over an hour. You can watch the tape. According to the defense filings, Holman lied to Allen's face. He told him five witnesses saw him with the girls and a gun. He told him experts had identified him and his voice on the video. None of it was true because none of it happened. Holman pushed relentlessly. He even tried using Allen's depression against him, suggesting it was because Allen killed two children. That didn't work either. When Holman used Allen's wife as an interrogation tool after ISP had lied to her that the bullet matched her husband's gun, Allen hugged her and said, "It's going to be all right." Left alone with her, he said, "I am not going to say something I did not do, and I can't explain something I don't understand." He told her, "I know that no bullet from my gun was connected to a murder in any way, shape, or form." Allen eventually had to get up and walk out to end the interview. That was Allen before solitary. With it, concise, clear. A few days after his arrest, Allen, who's 50, arrested for the first time in his life, was sent to the Indiana Department of Correction as a safekeeper. IDOC transferred him to the Westville Correctional Unit, mind you, with no hearing and no attorney involvement, nothing. The maximum security segregation unit that corrections officers described as a place for the worst of the worst. This from a man with no prior convictions should not be in prison, number one. Jail is what that is for. The movies call it the hole. It's used mostly to punish. Allen was the first pre-trial safekeeper in any IDOC employee's memory to be placed there. The standard practice was to house pre-trial detainees with mental health issues in mental health units. IDOC knew Allen carried a diagnosis of major depressive disorder. They knew he'd been hospitalized for suicidal ideation in 2019. He received a D medical health score, the second most severe, entitling him to one out-of-cell psychologist visit per week. During those visits, he was shackled inside a 3-by-3-foot cage separated from the psychologist by bars. That was his mental health treatment. Oh, and by the way, she was a big true crimer who was following the case. Hardly someone who should be handling this. The cell was 8.5 by 12.5 feet. Concrete slab with a mattress, camera running around the clock, bug infestation. His only view was a narrow window facing razor wire. Meals came through a slot in the door. He ate alone on the floor or his bed. There was no face-to-face human interaction unless he was shackled or separated by bars when they moved him outside the cell for showers, for attorney meetings, for anything. He was restrained with leg irons, handcuffs, and a belly chain on a lead. Guards with video cameras recorded him during showers and attorney meetings, allegedly. Suicide companions sat outside his door around the clock, documenting every word he said and every behavior they observed, regardless of whether he was on formal suicide watch, allegedly. IDOC's own policy restricts solitary confinement to 30 days for anyone with serious mental illness. The policy exists because decades of research acknowledged by IDOC's own internal documents show that prolonged isolation causes psychological trauma, psychosis, hallucinations, paranoia, and suicidal ideation, all the things you're trying to prevent, but you're actually creating an incubator for it. It happens in healthy people if you do that to them. Happens to anyone if you do that to them, really. A separate lawsuit against IDOC had produced an order and settlement agreement that expanded the definition of serious mental illness to include major depressive disorder. Allen's diagnosis. Under that definition, Allen's solitary confinement should have been limited to 30 days. If he decompensated into serious mental illness and was unlikely to return to general population for 30 days, the policy required a transfer to a mental health unit. But I guess policies aren't necessarily laws, is what we're learning here. Standards are only standards. They're not rules. IDOC did not apply the restriction. When Allen exhibited the predictable symptoms of deterioration, administrators refused to transfer him. The court refused to move him. The prosecutor collected his confessions. Allen remained in the most restrictive cell in the most restrictive solitary unit for 13 months. And if you see the fuckers who did this to him at the local Piggly Wiggly and go, oh, thank you for your service. You're a great officer. Maybe you should think twice about that. I'd think more like opening up the can of Coca-Cola, putting a Mentos on it and pointing it directly at them. That's just me. And I'm not saying anyone should do that to any of them. Soaking them in Coca-Cola fueled by Mentos. Ooh, how horrible that is. But my God. How does anybody look at the authority figures, the investigators, the police, the people who are making these decisions in this case and go, oh, these are great folks. These are great salt of the earth people that we really want serving and protecting. They're still in place there in Delphi, a town which there's no way in living hell I will ever set foot in. And I'm sure some of them are like, good, good. Well, good news for you is we're letting everybody know just what a shithole Delphi is and why you may never want to live there. And I know it looks real pretty. It looks quaint. It looks like a nice little small town. It'll probably be a ghost town within the next 20 years with the amount of lovely publicity that we're giving it. And the amount of people who might see this and go, yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe this isn't where I want to call home. Sorry. Unless you do something about the folks that are running your little town. I think we'll make it part of our mission to let everybody know why you don't want to set foot there. Good, we don't need more people. Yeah. Until your economy's gone, more than it already is. Within 2 weeks, Allen told his wife he was broken. Told her that if it became too much, she should call the detectives and he would tell them whatever they wanted to know. It wasn't a confession. It was a man describing the terms of his own psychological surrender before it happened. He was telling her in plain language that the conditions were already more than he could bear, and he wanted to relieve his wife of all of this, all this pain, all this suffering. He was willing to take the blame if he could lift the suffering that she was experiencing, which was a fraction of what he was experiencing from the outside, saying he'll say whatever to make this stop. Senator John McCain, who survived a prison camp, once said solitary crushes your spirit and weakens your resistance more effectively than any other form of mistreatment. Allen entered solitary confinement with a compromised mental state. It had been 2 weeks. Had his confinement been 30 days or even 90, the defense argues he would not have decompensated. But it was 13 months he was there. By April of 23, 5 months in, Allen weighed 135 pounds, came in at 180. He was psychotic, gravely disabled, confusing nightmares with reality, claiming he'd started World War III, playing with feces, declaring himself King Michael. Days before one of his confessions, he was too disjointed to hold a conversation. IDOC began involuntary administering antipsychotic injections. Between April and late June, early cell videos show Allen pacing his cell, lying down, doing leg crunches, writing, reading, looking distressed, but coherent. By April, coherence was gone. And the confession started pouring out. Over 60 to guards, to his psychologist, Dr. Walla, to his family on record recorded phone calls. He confessed to shooting the girls. They were killed with a blade. He expressed uncertainty about whether he'd essayed them. There's no evidence of that. He got basic facts of the crime wrong. The state collected all of it, monitoring and cataloging his statements, consumed hundreds of hours. ISP interviewed inmates and guards and even sent a psychologist to speak with Dr. Walla while confessions were ongoing. The prosecutor sought Allen's medical records, videos, and all communications while confessions were still happening, if that's what you want to call them. Most would say the ramblings of a madman, but hey, when you need a confession, I guess, you know, you could call it also ordering lunch from the Hello Deli. He didn't order lunch. Yes, but if we're calling that a confession, it was also a lunch order from the Hello Deli with Rupert G. In 1997, That's what he was doing too. That's not at all what he was doing. You're right. It also wasn't a confession. When Allen's defense attorneys filed an emergency motion to transfer him, citing his rapidly deteriorating mental state, the prosecutor waited 9 days to respond. During those 9 days, according to the defense, investigators were monitoring Allen's real-time phone calls, calls in which he was confessing. When the prosecutor finally responded, the filing described the defense's concerns as colorful and dramatic. That same day, IDOC's own records designated Allen as gravely disabled. The court refused to transfer him, putting the onus on IDOC to provide care within the same facility that was causing the actual deterioration. Why do you think they don't want him to be found innocent? Because all of these people in this circle who did this to this man will all be found guilty. And they all have lives to lead and families to take care of, families who supposedly love them, families who I hope watch this video and make a calculated choice to distance themselves from their loved ones. Sometimes you got to cut the cord. I'm sorry if these people involved in this story who did this to this man are somebody that you thought was somebody else, or maybe you've always kind of suspected they were kind of shitty. Well, here's your evidence. Probably the social distancing from these individuals that hopefully they're experiencing from their loved ones, from their friends, from their families, will take effect at some point and be far more damning than anything the legal system could do. Because I'm sure the legal system will not catch up and hold most of them responsible. All that can be done is social shaming and people who are around them that once saw them in a different light truly see them for who they actually are. In my opinion, these are allegations. It's my opinion. So there you go. Dr. Walla controlled all aspects of Allen's life in the cell, whether he got bedding, clothes, meal items, books, personal items, utensils, all of it flowed through her. She could provide a new window or a tablet or strip him to bare necessities, allegedly. According to the defense, after Allen confessed to Walla on May 3rd, he asked for his property back, and her notes indicate she told him she needed more consistency. Whether Walla had ill intent is irrelevant, the defense argues. What matters is what Allen thought, what solitary confinement was doing to him, and the fact that his basic comforts depended on the person he was confessing to. The confessions to his family happened on recorded phone calls and investigators were monitoring in real time. On April 3rd, he fell on the floor, asked if he was dead, and was suicidal. On May 10th, he believed he was dead, that the world would blow up if he slept, that his water was poisoned, and that he was reliving the same day over and over. On May 17th, he was paranoid about attorneys and staff who he believed were who wore Odin patches. Yes, Odinism. On May 25th, he paced for 2 hours and banged his head against the wall. On June 11th, he thought he was in hell and did not understand what was happening around him. These are the circumstances surrounding the confessions the state presented to the jury as evidence of a free and voluntary admission of guilt. In Indiana, they can torture the shit out of you. And, this is a voluntary admission of guilt. Only in America, as Brooks and Dunn would say. Allen's first confession to his wife included the words, "I think I did it," not "I did it." "I think I did it." The defense called Dr. Grassland, an expert on the psychological effects of solitary confinement, who testified that false memory starts with a belief. When you're isolated long enough, when you're treated as though you are guilty, you begin to think you are. The social isolation of solitary makes people question their sense of their self, their memories, their grasp on what is real. In Allen's first confession to Dr. Walla, he was unsure if he had S with the girls, got the facts wrong, he confessed to crimes that did not occur. He never once confessed to the actual crime. There is no confession out of Richard Allen that actually matches the crime. It's not the pattern of a man recounting what he knows. It's a pattern of a man whose grip on reality has been deliberately, systematically shattered by conditions, that his own institution acknowledged would cause exactly this result, this discombobulated delusion, which is what it is. But they didn't want it to be that, so they called it something else, a confession. These are the supposed sane people that are doing that part. Who's crazier? Dr. Westcott, a forensic psychologist who conducted a 127-page evaluation of Allen, concluded his psychosis stemmed from his major depressive disorder, his personality, and the well-documented effects of prolonged solitary confinement. Objective psychological testing ruled out malingering. Allen was not faking. By August of 23, he could not remember weeks of his own life. He could not remember confessing. He was terrified, unsure what was real, wondering if he was dead, in hell, or waiting for heaven. The defense argues this case, it presents a simple question with a clear answer. Should the state be able to benefit from Allen's psychological pain that their own deliberate indifference to his mental health caused? IDOC knew solitary would harm him. Their own policies prohibit it beyond 30 days for someone with his diagnosis. And when the predictable deterioration occurred, they refused to transfer him. When his attorneys begged the court for relief, the prosecutor mocked their concerns. On the same day, IDOC designated Allen gravely disabled. And then the state used the words that came out of that broken man's mouth as a centerpiece for a murder prosecution. Almost every guard who testified at the trial claimed Allen's bizarre behavior was orchestrated and not the product of genuine mental illness. And most of those people are also not qualified to work at a closed-down family video, which is why they're working there as a guard in the prison system. So spare me a moment while I don't take their psychological evaluation as having any merit at all. One dipshit guard said he knew Allen was truthful in his confession because he looked him in the eye. He looked me in the eye. Some claimed inmates commonly smear or eat feces as a tool for attention. Is that what they're doing? Hey, why is it you're a prison guard? Now, I guess some people, I guess, love the job. And if that's you, that's you. But a lot of people take that job, and I've seen it in my own world, in my own life, with people I know, because they couldn't get other ones. Because that was all the community offered as employment. And because a lot of those people didn't want to go anywhere else or do anything else. They wanted the paycheck. They wanted to show up. And look, I'm not trying to shit on prison guards here, but I'm also not going to treat these ones like they're fucking psychological professionals. Like they're some sort of expert that's going to give us some sort of insight into the mind of Richard Allen because he looked him in the eye. No. Sorry. Have it your way at Burger King. There you go. That's your next lateral move. None of these guards were mental health professionals. None knew Allen's mental health classification or could probably understand it. None had the training to distinguish malingering from genuine psychosis. I say put some of them in their solitary for over 30 days and see what happens. Let's see how quickly they start eating their own shit, having it their way, putting a little ketchup and mustard on it, calling it a whopper. Dr. Westcott, who did have that training and who administered objective psychological testing designed specifically to detect faking, found no evidence of malingering. The state asked the jury to trust corrections officers' gut feelings over a 127-page forensic evaluation backed by standardized testing. Yeah, those damn experts, those smart people, we don't need none of them. They looked, he looked the guard in the eye. That guard knew what it was because Jesus said it was real. What? I'm telling you. We're living in the upside down. Idiocracy is taking hold. And the jury, who never heard the audio of what Allen actually sounded like during these episodes, who never saw the video of him pacing his cell or banging his head or failing, falling on the floor, flailing, had no way to judge for themselves whether the guards or the psychologist were right. It's all presented as fact. The state used those confessions to convict Richard Allen. How solid do you think they were? If you're like, there's got to be more to this. I mean, really? I mean, there's a lot more to the story and to the whole case, but everything I just gave you there was probably one of the most detailed accounts that I've ever done on this show about his experience in solitary confinement, and it's all fact. Now, you certainly got my opinion mixed in there and how I feel about the people who did this, but what happened to him, those events that I spoke about of Richard Allen and what he endured, all fact. If you are okay with it, I guess, you know, go on to the next kitten video or whatever you're watching. If you're angry, share this. Comment. Let people know this ain't okay, because right now the state of Indiana is, Richard Allen has been convicted. He's in prison. He's dying in prison. And the clock is ticking for this man to be able to get out. I'm doubtful he ever will. And the state of Indiana would be very happy about that, because if anything changes with this man's conviction, all of these people are in for a world of hurt. Let's bring them the hurt, shall we? Share this. Give me your thoughts. Let people know this is going on. We'll continue our conversation in the comment section. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.